Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Tuesday, March 12th, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that they start here in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That chapter of the book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet, and it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you choose to do that, before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they actively apply these tools in their lives, and secondarily because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. And if you have any of those to share with us, we'd appreciate you doing so by giving us a call at 563-999-3581. Once you call that number, if you press 1 on your phone, it'll put the little icon of a hand by your phone number, and I'll be able to turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code. And we appreciate whenever anybody does that, because it makes it far easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be a service. And if you would allow us to know how that we can be of service to you, it just makes it far easier for us to do that effectively. And today's a Tuesday, so there will be a support group this evening. All the information you would need on how to join us in that support group is available at MindShiftersAcademy.org website. So, I have somebody in the chat room who's saying, I had sent message through email since this chat is closed if I miss it during work. Another question, has Michael observed what makes a person mind be either right, wrong, or wrong, not wrong? Is there anything that makes a mind swap viewing modes? Well, I will make sure that that question is available for Michael. And in the next hour when he gets on, maybe he will answer that directly. Area code 610, you're in the air.
Hi, Dr. Tim. I might be interrupted, so I wanted to come on early. I listened to that Gruber podcast because I'm on the feed now. It comes right through, and I was up early. Fantastic. You know what? I think his solution, it breaks down borders. And if we could have think tanks, global think tanks, people would sorry, I'm going right off on it, but I just loved that podcast and felt so much hope because I don't think as separate countries we can probably solve the problems we have. But so I just wanted to recommend that to podcast, David Gruder, and interviewed by Dr. Tim Hayes himself. People should listen to it. It's very inspiring and practical.
It's from the On Your Mind podcast, and it's an episode that just dropped today. So thank you for that. I'm glad you listened and found it useful. It's one of several things that are going these days where people are trying to build collectives, build people who are trying to counteract the let's divide everybody and fight, and people who are working together to build positive, synergistic, collaborative solutions. And there's another one. I'm trying to find it right now in my email feed because I've clicked on it a few times because they've got, it's a different group doing basically the same kind of thing, trying to bring people together to say it's us as a collective, not us versus them.
Mm.
So if I find that, if they, you know, have followed through and another one that's good is the Together Rising nonprofit that was started by, I think that's the one with Glennon Doyle and some other people. And they choose people that need funds for some kind of crisis, and they make sure the funds get to them in a usable way, quickly and immediately. And they are people who, you know, they take surveys of their group and say, okay, so what is our group thinking we should be donating to and finding solutions for?
I had a long talk with one of my grandsons, a brilliant young fellow who we talked about politics. And he just said, you know, capitalism as it's working now isn't working. He said, what we need is a social democracy. But the word socialism scares people. And I looked up what a synonym would be for socialism, and it was left wing, which is just puts us right back in the us and them department. But he was saying there are so many ways that we could solve our problems. I'm tempted. Actually, it hadn't occurred to me to send that Gruber thing to him. He's a freshman in college, so it's not going to have a lot of time. But he would love that podcast. Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for it.
Well, in the first episode of that podcast, Dr. Gruder was offering a definition for capitalism that is I think there's a level of genius in it. It's relatively simple, but it's acknowledging that when I come by whatever kind of currency that I come by, I had to exchange my life energy in one form or another to accumulate that currency.
Right. I remember that.
And so when I give somebody my currency, I'm giving them the fruit of my life energy. I'm voting with my feet, so to speak. And if we wake people up to understanding that that's really what's happening, that you're spending your energy in your life, and then it has a certain level, a whole different level of value when you think of it that way. And there's a level of respect for the person, a level of respect for the transaction, and it kind of helps us rewire the way we're thinking about capitalism. And that was the On Your Mind podcast from a week ago. So that was, you know, that was posted on the 5th. But if you go to onyourmindpodcast.org or journeysdream.org/podcast, you can access both of those. And I'm very glad that you found it interesting and useful. I think that you know, the book Redemption that we mentioned in that podcast by Bernie Dorman is not a great book, but some absolutely great concepts in it. And, you know, the idea around how do you collaborate? How do you work synergistically with people? It is so much more useful than the competition and, you know, might makes right model.
Right. I wondered how he was going to implement his idea when he does make an us and them thing of the people who are the mechanistic, is that what he called them? And the people who are, he had a word, spiritus, homo spiritus,
right.
And homo,
okay.
Anyway, I can't remember it.
So, homo deus, right? So humans that are godlike, and there's he mentioned an author whose name I would have to go look up, but he wrote a book saying that he believes Homo sapiens are no more, that we've actually we've evolved to the point where we're not really Homo sapiens anymore, we're godlike, and that we're smarter than God. That's what this author put forth in his book. And the solution that he comes up with in that process is that we should have the smartest humans and give them all the power and money and have them create a society that's best for us humans. And so David Grutter has termed that, you know, homo machina. In other words,
yeah, that's what it was.
We're machines.
Yeah.
And he is promoting homo spiritus, meaning we are humans as spirit. We are spirit beings in the human form. And his model is not give the power over to the smartest and let them determine what everybody should do, but let's bring the collective together, that together we are far more fruitful and intelligent than any one person alone or any small group of people alone. And that's what he's trying to promote with his website and the group that he's beginning called the Center for Enlightened Self-Sovereignty. And he talks about how our founding fathers understood that it was important to have the rights of the individual and what's best for the collective good. And that if you have one without the other, it doesn't work well.
So he does say that we should use both groups, Homo Spiritus and Homo Machina, or whatever it is.
No, he's saying that the interpretation of us as having become smarter than God has left
you didn't
this
like that
with,
too much.
Pardon me?
The way you laughed, I knew you didn't like that too much.
Well, you know, I don't think there's any good grounds for it from all of the teachings that I've experienced. And it leads to a grandiosity. It leads to a narcissism.
Yeah. Oh, my
right?
God.
It leads to the tyranny, as Dr. Gruder was mentioning. And so in an effort to acknowledge that we're growing and that we're tapping into other sources of wisdom and energy, and that we're not just, you know, mechanistic, animalistic beings anymore, Dr. Gruder says, okay, so let's acknowledge that we are spirit beings having this earthly experience, and let's not get sidetracked thinking that we're so great. Let's use our collective intelligence to see what we might evolve into in the next level. Let's do what the most brilliant minds that set up the Constitution of the United States, et cetera, what those brilliant minds said, let's keep some of the best of what they came up with, which is acknowledging that if you have a passion for human individual rights and a passion for what's good for the collective whole, you can keep a balance that brings everyone up. But if you have one over the other, if you have just a passion for individual rights and you're not concerned about the collective good, you end up with narcissism and you end up with, you know, civil wars and embattlement. And if you have people who just want the collective good, you end up with a totalitarianism. You end up with a tyranny. So it's the two together that we, you know, looking for yes and solutions in life.
Right.
And inviting everyone to the table who's willing to come to the table. And hopefully that makes sense. I mean, that's what he's trying to create, is just another format where people are asked, okay, look, if you see problems in the world, let us hear from you what you see as problems and how you see them as problems. And what he talks about is he wants people not who are like-minded, but who are like-spirited, who have common values, and who are multi-minded, divergently minded, and bring those divergent minds together so there's this creative synergy that happens. We don't want everybody to be walking in lockstep and just follow what we think is best. We want great ideas from people, but people who are focused on the individual and the collective whole, and the best for the collective of the collective good. And then bring your divergent ideas into this model, and we'll see what we come up with. And in his Spark profile, he outlines a whole series of things that you might do for yourself to define what your values are and what's important to you and how you might contribute. And if you don't know how you might contribute, they're suggesting here are some tools that you might develop if you don't have them already, personal self-growth tools. And then when you use those tools and you feel stronger, then bring the fruits of the use of those tools to a group like the Center for Enlightened Self-Sovereignty. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say that I don't know whether he actually said this, but as he was speaking, I pictured that he was casting a far wider net than just solving problems in our own country, that this would be
a whole global effort collecting people from everywhere who wanted to take part in this and solving problems for individual countries through that wide net.
Well, yeah, it is a global image that he's working with.
Very exciting, very hopeful. Boy, it would be great if we could do that. Anyway, good interview. Are you going to do with him?
Well, we might. It all depends on, you know, what people are interested in and what he and his wife, Lori, are working on.
Yeah.
It is, it was a bit of a stretch for me to put that out on the Mind Shifters, not on the Mind Shifters, it fits right in with the Mind Shifters radio when I had them on for a joint call on the 23rd of last month. But it was a bit of a stretch to put that out for the On Your Mind podcast because it's not strictly mental health, but it is all about fundamental healthy human functioning and purpose in life. And so,
yeah, I can see what you mean. It never occurred to me, but right. I do think if they, are you the one that calls the shots on that? Because I think it was a wonderful decision.
Well, I'm the one who called this shot. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I am definitely the one who called this shot, and I have some discretion in that since I'm the one doing all the work on it. But I do yield to the founders, the four founders of Journey's Dream, if they have differing opinions about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's inviting a kind of global relational mental health. I can see how it fits, but it is, it's not specific. I see what you mean. It's not addressing mental illnesses per se.
I'm quite hopeful that in the near future I'll be able to interview Robert Whittaker again. He's the author of Mad in America and Anatomy of an Epidemic, both powerful books that have really moved me and helped educate me and raise some really useful questions for anybody in the mental health field and anybody who's got friends or family that are facing mental health struggles. And in an email on Monday, he or Friday, he agreed to be interviewed again. So I'll look forward to what he's got happening and how things have changed in his life in the past 3 years since I interviewed him. His website that people can go check out is Mad in America. And it is a website that invites people to tell their stories about their mental health struggles. And, you know, the website itself says Mad in America is the title of the website, and the subtitle is Science, Psychiatry, and Social Justice.
Mm.
So.
Sounds good.
Well, and there are blogs that you can blog posts from people that have had lived experience. And there are you know, research news categories on that website and different radio interviews that he's done, Robert Whittaker has done. So if you're looking for resources related to mental health and something other than just you know, here's a list of symptoms, let's pair that with a medication and send you on your way, Mad in America is a good resource for some people.
Mm.
So, other thoughts? Any thoughts about the conversation from yesterday that you and I were having?
I can't remember it now. My mind's so much on that podcast. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes, I thought a lot about conscious. I'm using the word conscious. It helps a lot just to become conscious. Kind of come into the present. That was very helpful, just that one word.
Yeah, it is. It's quite the process that we're all of us are called to engage in to rewrite our programming, and it is not an easy thing to do. We are each and every one of us programmed from birth. Once we're given our language and we're given our family instructions and we're taught by our family members, you know, what is most important. And that, whether we realize it or not, that becomes our conditioning, or becomes our programming.
Yeah. Mm. So true. Well, we've got two situations going on here. The grandson I've been talking about, who has now been cut off by his entire family because he is being so unbelievably insulting and belligerent, because we are not going to fund his entire life once he graduates from college, and he's pushing himself out onto the street, meanwhile saying, "You're making me homeless." He's in a completely blaming mode, and I really think he's under the influence of weed and alcohol. He insists he's not addicted to them. He could stop them anytime. But I think the weed has hurt his mind. I don't think we're going to go to his graduation. I mean, it's really become extremely uncomfortable. And then I have my son, the doctor, has gone into quite a spiral, a bad depression, and he says things like, "I know my thinking is wacky." I've been trying to get him to call you, Dr. Tim. It's just not happening, but at this point. But practicing being detached and staying conscious.
Well, and the other thing to remember to do is to actively practice the gentle art of blessing.
Mm. Yeah, picturing him well, thanking
right.
God
I mean,
for
like,
his health.
The one of the things that we talk about in the Way of Mastery talks about it, and in the Darshans they talk about it even more. Yeshua didn't heal anybody.
Yeah.
What Yeshua did was see their true nature and invite them to see that themselves as sick or wounded was a false out-picturing of some internal thoughts that were unproductive. And when people would join him in his accurate seeing of them as vibrant and healthy and connected to their source, and if when people would join him in that, they would have an experience that was transformative, and people would call that a healing. Others might call it a return to wholeness, right? The ability to see themselves accurately. Well, that's exactly what... Say that again?
Do you think that was conscious on the part of the healed person, that they were...
Well, here's the idea. And in the darshans, in the way of mastery, I meant not to darshans, but in the Q&A from the way of mastery when that was being channeled,
right.
They talk about the very few times that there was any follow-up done on those miracle healings. And I'm putting the word miracle in quotes because, you know, in this sense, a miracle is simply something that happens that you didn't know could happen before it happened, right? You didn't know it was possible until it happened. But
right.
So the idea is in the Q&A, they're asked the question, what happens to those people? And the answer is,
yeah.
On the few times there was any follow-up, it wasn't long before the symptoms returned because
right.
the people didn't believe their own outpicturing, and they returned
mm-hmm.
to viewing themselves the way they had before. So,
right.
You know, Michael Rice likes to talk about in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh. And that was the interpretation we get from the Greek interpretation of the first word of the Hebrew Bible, the Torah, right? So the Aramaic meaning of that is more like in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became flesh. So the mind energy is itself a creative force. So if the people
mm-hmm.
believe that they're sick and they're damaged and they're unworthy and unlovable, that creates their outpicturing.
Mm-hmm. So Jesus, Yeshua, had a phenomenal capacity to see the person as whole, and the person was pulled into that and managed to be whole, but in some cases they didn't retain that after Jesus left the scene.
Well, what they're saying is most of the time they didn't retain it.
Wow.
Because as you were just asking, you triggered me to bring this up because you said, you asked the question, do I think it was conscious? And my answer is, if it doesn't become conscious, then the old unconscious pattern takes over and you see the effects of it. The outpicturing that you get is that the symptoms or the illness or the defectiveness returns. Because if people believe they are defective and pour enough of their mind energy into that, they create an experience of themselves as defective.
God, that's like the whole placebo phenomenon and all that. When I
exactly.
was very young, I was in my early 20s, I started losing my eyesight, and I didn't worry about it. Even when I was unable to drive or read, it got that bad. And then finally, after a million doctors, I've mentioned this before, I was diagnosed with the corneas were becoming misshapen because I had been using hard contact lenses for so long. My eyes didn't feel that I was hurting my eyes. So I wore them longer than I should have, and dry eye and all this stuff. So I got one eye fixed. But all along, I'm reading my mother's letters, and she's worrying so much about my eyes. And I don't know how you can take this so as if it's nothing. And I'm thinking, I really wasn't worried. But I did have a mechanical intervention. I did picture that this just isn't going to end badly. I'm going to be able to see. And I had confidence in that and found the right doctor and had new corneas sewn on and had to be 3 operations, not 2. But even so, my mother kept saying, why are you so worried? Well, I'm saying 2 things. One thing is that I wasn't worried. Perhaps I could have, if my mind energy was strong enough, I could have gotten well without even an operation. But we believe in operations. I had confidence in operations. I had confidence in doctors, even though the first 7 of them couldn't figure out what the matter was and said I should go to a psychiatrist. I'm going off on a terrible tangent, but I'm trying to fit it in.
But
it's
not so much of a tangent. You're saying it's what you believed
yeah.
ended up creating a large part of your experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same thing. That's what we're saying. Your mind energy is a creative force. Yeshua didn't heal anybody. Yeshua stood with people and stood as the experience with his knowledge of how we're all connected. He'd seen through the false beliefs about himself, and he'd seen the true nature that everyone is just as he is. So he would stand next to them, basically shining the light more directly and brighter than they were able to hold for themselves. And if they would buy into it, then they would have a transformation. And when they mm-hmm. quit buying into it, when he left and they didn't believe it was real and they thought it was him doing all the healing, then their symptoms would come back.
Yeah. In our culture, we put a lot of faith in the mechanical activities of doctors, though. I don't think I would have been healable by Jesus just one-on-one. But I did have faith in what the doctors could do, which had to do with using a needle and cutting off a cornea and getting a dead person's cornea and sticking it in there. And somehow that seemed like a route to healing.
If you read the book, as we've suggested before, on the placebo and the nocebo effect.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the suggestible you. Where they bring a lot of research into this idea of the placebo effect, or as Bruce Lipton would call us to name it, give it something with more reverence. Call it the belief effect. The power of what you believe in to change your life is beyond words.
Mm-hmm.
And generally speaking, when people talk about the placebo effect, they're discounting it as fake or false or trickery.
Yeah.
But when they talk about the power of this in that book, and you get to hear the research studies and the case studies and the percentage of people that are cured just because they believe in what they're taking, it introduces the question, what if every effect from any medication is as much or more related to the belief effect than it is to a medication making a change?
Yeah.
You know, one of the studies in there that they quoted, they had somebody who was having very, very strong effects from Parkinson's.
Mm-hmm.
And it was to the point where he couldn't play ball with his son.
Mm.
And he and his doctor found out about a trial of a new medication that they were doing, and he got signed up for the trial of this medication. Now, when you try a medication, in order for it to be, you know, the gold standard of trials these days, you have to have a group that is a control group and a group that's a placebo group and a group that actually gets the actual treatment. Well, the difficulty with this particular treatment was, for Parkinson's, they had a new medication, but the medication had to be injected into the brain through the skull.
Wow.
So how do you make that a placebo? How do you convince people that they've gotten the treatment when they haven't gotten the treatment, if the treatment requires that you have a surgery that drills through the skull and then injects a needle into the specific part of the brain and then, you know, injects the medicine through that needle? Well, what they did was they would take people into the surgery room, and they would have them unconscious, and they would numb them out, and they would make an incision with the skull, in the skull, in the same place they would if they were going to inject through the needle, and then they would drill like halfway through the skull to cause an indent, and then they would keep them in the surgery room as long as they would if they actually had to do, bring the little microsurgeon over and the, you know, the robot to put that thing in, and they kept them in there the same amount of time as if they were actually going to inject the brain with the medication, and then they would sew them up, and then they would send them out, and nobody knew who got the medicine and who didn't.
So
they had the control group, and they had the actual group where they had medicine injected into their brain, and they had the group where they thought they had medicine injected into their brain, and they had a little bit of a surgery, and they had a, you know, stitches that had to heal, and they had an indent in their skull, and nobody knew. Now, the person they were talking about and his doctor were thrilled because his symptoms all but disappeared, and he was able to ride a bike again and throw a ball and play with his son. And they were so excited because they found a cure for Parkinson's. And they were absolutely convinced that he was in the group that got the actual treatment, and wasn't this great news. Now, the deal is that at the end of the study, at the two-year period or whatever, everybody who's in the group gets told whether they had the placebo or the actual medication.
Oh, my
God. And
at the end of the study,
they had to reveal that this is not an effective medication for Parkinson's. And they were shocked and said, what do you mean it worked so well for me? And they said, well, the deal is you didn't get the medication.
Whoa.
So this guy who had the dramatic transformation did not get the treatment, but he believed he did. Here's the other part of that study. They call it the placebo effect, which is the positive benefit when you think that something has happened, right?
Yeah.
The other part of the study is the nocebo effect, which means when you have a negative effect that you think is attributable to something, but you haven't even had that substance. What they found in this study is that the people in the placebo effect who never got the brain injection, they actually developed more negative side effects than the people that had the medicine injected into their brain. Try to wrap your mind around that.
You mean because they thought they had got it and they figured they would have side effects?
Exactly. They were told what they might, because, you know, when you get a medication, they tell you, here's a list of possible side effects. Watch out for this. Watch out for that. You know, let
so
us know
weird.
If it gets really bad. But if you have this, this, and this, it might go away in a week or two. So that's what they told people. And the people who did not get the medication, they were in the control, in the placebo group. But they thought they had the medication injected into their brain. They reported more negative side effects than the people who actually had the medication injected into their brain.
Dr. Tim, before you go any further, were these people aware that they were either in one group or another, or were these people just worked on as if they're getting the real deal, all of them? They didn't know they were part of an experiment.
No. They had to know they were part of an experiment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right? They had to know, they had to agree that they were going to be in this trial.
Yeah.
And they had to agree to not know whether they got the placebo or the actual treatment. And they had to agree to be randomly put in either the control group where they didn't get any treatment at all, or the group where they actually got the treatment, or the group where they had the incision and the drill in the skull but no treatment. And they wouldn't know whether they were put in the treatment group or the placebo group.
Mm-hmm.
They knew they were part of
or
an experiment.
The control group.
Well, in the control group, they didn't take them in and fake any surgery.
Oh,
so
I
they
see.
Knew they were in the control group.
All right.
But they didn't know if they had gotten the treatment or if they were in the placebo group because they went in and had this, you know, operating room experience.
So some of them believed they'd gotten the injection.
All of them believed. All of them believed they had gotten the injection.
Uh-huh.
If they were in the treatment group or the placebo group, they all believed they got the injection.
Okay. So they weren't told that they're... Okay, they were told that they were part of an experiment, but not...
They weren't told whether they were going to get the placebo or they were going to get the full-on treatment until after 2 years had elapsed.
Wow.
And the rules of the study were at the end of it, they had to tell people whether or not they got the actual treatment and what the results of the study were.
So was it random that the people who didn't get the real treatment or the people that did, some had side effects and some didn't according to what they really believed? I've got lost in there.
The assignment to the groups was random.
Yeah.
And all he's reporting on in this book, Suggestible You, is the results. And the results surprised everybody because some people had a reduction in symptoms and some people who had a reduction in symptoms didn't even get the treatment.
Yeah.
And the people who did not get the treatment but thought they did, they developed more negative side effects than the people that actually got the brain chemistry altered by injection. So The point is, you asked about whether or not it has to be conscious for, like, you know, if Yeshua is standing next to someone and holds them in a blessing and their physiology transforms and their blindness goes away and their lameness heals, etc. You ask, does it have to be conscious for that to be maintained? We don't know, but our guess is the person has to believe that they will stay healthy, strong, whole, whatever. If the person believes that they're only healthy, strong, and whole because somebody did something to them from the outside and then that's taken away, more than likely their symptoms will return. Why? Because they believe it will return.
In the case of, there are two cases of in the New Testament of the blind, a blind man born blind from birth and another man, we don't know if he was blind from birth. Both were healed of their blindness and given their sight. The testimony there for the ones who were blind was they could see. Just the fact that they could see would probably take away any doubt about their being able to see, and I don't see why they would lose their sight subsequently because...
Okay, but think about it. Think about it, Susan. Just slow down and take a breath. If they believed that the only reason they were seeing was because Jesus was there doing the energy work, and then Jesus leaves, and they start to doubt, and they fear, uh-oh, if he's not here to fix me, what if it's their mind? This is what the book Suggestible You is saying, that the test results indicate that if I believe everything's going to fall to hell, everything more often than not falls to hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I
people
understand.
Who had no medication added to their brain were told, we added medication to your brain, even though we didn't, and they were told, when you get this medication in your brain, you're likely to have these negative side effects.
Mm-hmm.
And more of those people who did not get the medication developed the negative side effect than the people that actually got the medication. This is called the nocebo effect. This is mm-hmm. called, I believe I'm sick, I'm unworthy, I'm damaged, I'm unlovable,
mm-hmm.
and I bring on physiological disruption simply because of the application of my mind energy, my creative force, mm-hmm. mind energy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is so true with depression, isn't it? I really think that's got to be true, probably with anxiety too. Taking it off the topic we were just on, but I'm thinking about my son and the fact that he says, my thoughts are wacky. We had a leaky toilet. He comes over and we had called the plumber. And we told him about it just offhand. And he said, oh, I can fix it. And he raced down the hill. It was the weekend. He came down, took everything apart, found the faulty part. We went to Home Depot, got a part. He put it all together and left a little folded cloth under the area that might be leaking and said, let me know if this still leaks. In the middle of the night, he texted or emailed and said, I'm worried about, I forgot to flush the toilet. I don't know whether I really fixed it. He was obsessing. Next morning, I would go check the cloth, and it was soaked. It was still leaking. And I answered his text in the morning and said, sorry to say, it's still leaking. We're going to get the plumber. He beat himself up to smithereens because he had not fixed the toilet. And he went on to say things like, I feel totally worthless. Here's this amazing surgeon who, if he isn't in there doing extra hours and saving a gazillion lives, feels worthless. Now, that is a thought disorder. So I'm going off on a huge tangent, but all of this came about because of that in a way.
Well, and that is exactly what Dr. Michael Rice would say. It is a thought disorder.
Mm. Well, almost the whole hour has gone by. Dr. Tim, do you want to say other stuff than working on this?
Well, but this is the core for all of us, right? If I believe there's something damaged, broken, and wrong with me, it doesn't matter how much the truth of my existence is, that I am connected to my source and can't ever be separated.
Mm.
So we started this because I made the recommendation that instead of fretting over your grandson or your son, that you actively practice the gentle art of blessing.
Mm.
And you can find out about the gentle art of blessing by reading his book, The Gentle Art of Blessing, or his book, 365 Blessings to Heal Myself and the World. And he is Pierre Pradervand, Pradervand. And if you want, you can go to mindshiftersacademy.org, find the little magnifying glass that indicates an ability to search a website, and click on it, and then type in the word Pierre, and it will take you to a separate page that just has that interview where I had him on Mind Shifters Radio years ago.
Wonderful.
And you can and you can hear him in his own words discuss the gentle art of blessing, and you can see how it might be more beneficial for yourself and anybody you care about than sitting in the angst,
ooh,
in the nervous energy, in the depressed energy, in the worry. So I recommend very strongly that instead of you talking about all these horrible things going on with your grandson and your son. Instead of that, you spend that same time practicing the gentle art of blessing, creating an image of them in their highest and best, with them aware of their connection to their Creator, with them living from their, you know, highest loving, highest intelligence, highest compassion, highest gratitude, and just keep pouring your mind energy into those images and visualize sending it to them. Why? Well, because in the first place, it's a far more pleasant way for you to spend your time than sitting in worry and fretting and wringing your hands and imagining all of the horrible things that are going to befall them if nothing changes. In the second place, there's every possibility, since we're living in an energetic universe, that you will be adding a positive energy to the field that's interacting with them. And that's all. That's all there is to it. It's your choice. How are you going to spend your mind energy? I hit this multiple times every week with people in therapy because they want to talk about, but this is really happening and this is really real. I say, yes, it's really happening. And it is not the only thing that's happening. It's a very, very small percentage of what's happening. And it's your choice about what you're going to focus on. Are you going to focus on that very small percentage of the negative things that are happening in life right now? Or are you going to focus on the much higher percentage of the positive things that are happening in life right now?
Really good, Dr. Jim.
And what you focus your mind energy on, you're going to add energy to and create more of. So that's all on target for me. That's not way off target, and you didn't hijack the show, and we're not talking about anything that's any different than everything else we talk about here, which is how are we creating our experience of life moment to moment? What is it in us that gives rise to our experience? It's right in line with what the Way of Mastery calls us to. It's right in line with the Reality Management Worksheet. And if it wasn't in line with the Reality Management Worksheet, there'd be no point in doing a Reality Management Worksheet. Because if the upset in my life, if the pain and the grief and the suffering in my life was actually caused by the people and things outside of me, there'd be no benefit to doing a worksheet that has me focusing on what am I doing with my mind energy. So thank you for the comments and the questions, and it's right on target. You didn't distract from anything, and I will spend some of my own mind energy in the next day or two in the gentle art of blessing directed towards you and your family members.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Tim.
You're very welcome and deserving. I'll mute you so you can listen to the second hour. I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff that we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And I'll turn on the microphone for and announce Jeannie Rice.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I only caught the tail end of your show, but it sounded like it was awesome.
Well, we try. Have a wonderful show.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mind Shifters Radio. And today is Tuesday, March the 12th, 2024. And our calling number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we would love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And while we're waiting on Michael to dial in, I will just remind you to go to the website, whyagain.org. And let's see, this Thursday we have the book club. And UK has not changed time zone yet. So it, where normally the book club is 3:30 our time, it will be 4:30 for the next couple of Thursdays until I think they change on the 30th of the month. So we will, and let me see if Michael's having any issues getting in. That will be an hour later. This coming Saturday is the Still Point Breathing at 11 o'clock. If you're not part of that and you would like to be, contact Michael or myself, and we'll get you registered, get you signed up. Everybody's given mind shifters on Friday to do before we breathe on Saturday. We do processing, and then we meet again on Sunday. So that's coming up this coming weekend. So this week is going to be busy. Let's see, what else? We do have a question in the chat room, but we'll wait until Michael gets on, and then I'll ask that question. So I think you answered all the questions that you already had, right? Okay, well, we got one in the chat room. So when you finish getting connected there, I will read it. Hope that you're following. I was a little late getting the links out there on the web page. If you go to the website, Why Again, and then over under Kaboris, click on Enlightenment Study, and there's all the archives for the shows. And I didn't get yesterday's on until this morning. So if you tried to find those and they weren't out there, that's why. Human, not error, but just human delayed. So we hope that you're putting the tools to work in your life. Because they do work. We tell people, you know, don't believe anything we have to say, but use the tools and you'll see that they do work. So, Michael's not on yet. Mr. Michael, there he is. So welcome to the show. And like I said, we do have a question in the chat room when you're ready for it.
Thank you, dear heart. Honored, delighted to be here, and you have a question for us. Let's go for the question.
All right. It is Sean in the chat room. He says, hey, guys, I'd sent questions through the email since this chat is closed. If I miss it during work, here's another question. We did answer your other emails yesterday, Sean. Has Michael observed what makes a person's mind be in either right, not right, or wrong, not wrong? Is there anything that makes a mind swap viewing modes?
Yes. What filter is active determines literally what one sees. And that's why Yeshua, when he was asked, what's most important? What's the first law? Now, remember that in Aramaic, the word law means the way things work. How do you make it work to function as a human being? And what Yeshua says is you must have rachma. Rachma is the primary first condition in the mind that must be set for a human life to enter a human form. You'll notice we've got lots and lots and lots of human forms running around, and void of the presence and the experience of love, there is no human life in those human forms. Human life, I would offer, is love. Life itself is love moving through a form when we have a human. So the first order of business in order to have love moving in our form is this condition of rachma. It's a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that allows only information from brain cells that are keyed to love to be used as a raw material forming our goals. Once that is done, then a second filter is activated in the mind called Kuba. And Kuba is the filter over perception. that only allows information that is keyed to love that's stored in brain cells to pass into awareness to be used in building our personal perception, our personal reality. Rachma and Kuba together were called in Aramaic perfect love. You remember perfect love casts out fear, i.e. one, fear is being spoken about as a demon kind of thing. And how do you get rid of it? A mind based in Rachma and Kuba cannot generate a fear-based reality. So that would be the primary conditions to produce a true human life, and the true presence of love in physiology, our created essence. The alternative filters, as we've talked about previously, are hostility and fear. And so when hostility or fear are active, there are a set of filters over the frontal lobes of the brain, a set of filters over the back of the brain. When Rachma is active, only intentions keyed to love are available. If fear is active, then only negative intentions or information keyed to negativity is available for intentions. And if hostility is active, then only destructive information is available as the raw material for setting our goals. Goals drive the perceptual mind. So if hostility is the quality of the goal, then whatever object of attention, doesn't matter who I'm looking at, if hostility is set in my mind, and we have a saying in this culture that honors this particular principle from the Aramaic, although I don't know of anywhere it's ever been explained as to why. But you notice we've got a saying that says, oh, he got out of bed on the wrong side this morning. What does that mean? His hostility filter set. Doesn't matter what or who he looks at, the most cherished person he's going to find irritating because his perceptual mind is key to irritation. And if the fear filter set, then it doesn't matter who or what he looks at, he's going to experience what's in his mind that's based in threat. His reality, his perceptual construct, is going to be based in threat. And so he's going to be threatened by whoever or whatever he looks at. Restore Rachma, and the same object of attention elicits love from that mind rather than fear or hostility. So that would be my best take on that topic. And then, of course, if we find ourselves, I had another question from an individual, so I decided to touch in and go over this particular piece in the dictionary. Let's turn to page here. If one is going to clean up one's mind of hostility or fear, the fact that the database that we're working from to build our intentions and perceptions is multi-generational. Many of the dynamics that come up when hostility or fear are active are things that have come from generations and generations, sometimes and generations ago. You know, people say, you know, well, when I did that behavior, I didn't feel like myself. I felt like something took, you know, the person who's standing in front of the judge and the judge says, what did you do? You've got a good reputation. What happened? Or says, I don't know. I didn't feel like myself. It was like something took me over. Yeah, something took him over. Something of a generational pattern. And accessing, especially in our culture with the kind of outward focus, you'll notice that, you know, right from day one with the little child, what do we tend to do? We tend to get them to look at shiny things. We make funny faces. We make funny noises. We show them things that grab their attention and keep them outward focused. Who teaches a child to go within? One of the practices we've been doing with Arya Rain. She now will lead us in a meditation. We tell her it's time for a meditation. So it's my turn to do it. Okay, close your eyes, take a deep breath, and relax, and she'll guide us into meditation. But the world tends to keep us focused out there, and so we develop all kinds of skills for experiencing out there. But when it comes to moving in here, inside, well, most people just don't have the skills because they've never been taught it. This work is about that. And how do we clean up some sort of horrific thing that happened maybe 10, 20, 30 generations ago and has been impacting the bloodline over and over and over with that traumatic energy? What do we do with that? Well, Yeshua gave us a tool of forgiveness, and forgiveness is a totally and completely different thing than our culture has taught us. Our culture has taught us that, well, if my mind is accessing some sort of unresolved trauma from within its database and building me a perceptual construct based in trauma that I can now easily blame somebody else for because I was trained to be a member of the one world universal religion of blame by the time I was four, then my mind out of my trauma builds a trauma-based reality, perception, a construct that puts all of my trauma into my brain's image of them, and I really think they're the cause of my trauma. You know, there's a smelly line that comes to mind when I say those words. How long has this been going on? Generation after generation after generation. Look at that story of the Jews wandering in the desert. They got lost in this hot, this 35-square-mile hot, sandy place for 40 years. Now, if you believe that's a true, literal story, I have a bridge for sale. I mean, it's a silly concept to think that this group of people, who obviously are very bright and know a whole lot about astronomy, they've written a lot about it, that they could possibly get lost in a 35-square-mile area and not have any idea how to get out. Not have any idea that, oh, the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. We know we want to go west, so let's follow the sun. Doesn't take many days to get out of a 35-square-mile area. This is not about a hot, sandy place. What did they say had to happen to get out of the desert? The desert, which is a code word for the unconscious. What they said was the old generation had to die off. Now, to the root of the word generation is genari, it means cause. It doesn't mean everybody in old physical bodies had to physically die. It meant that we had to go in and deal with the causes in our minds that were based in trauma. And you say, well, gee, Michael, you told me about this research from Harvard that says that in a time frame where 10,000 brain cells are firing, the max amount of data that comes into conscious awareness is 9 bits of data. And you tell me that I've got a multi-trillion bit database. How am I ever going to clean up a multi-trillion bit generational, multi-generational database doing it 9 bits at a time? Well, I'll tell you what, you're never going to do it that way. It's just not going to happen. And there is an elemental force that 2,000 years ago Yeshua taught was within us. And remember that our study with this Enlightenment book is to develop new brain cells to be able to see through Aramaic eyes. And you recall that in the early days, as we were starting this study, we talked about the fact that there were certain words that were left in Aramaic because either there was so much confusion in the current understanding, or there was just no such concept. So what Yeshua taught about is the fact that there is a feminine elemental force in us that when invited into activity will undo the effects of our errors and teach us the truth. What might the effects of our errors be? Well, when you realize that you are an energetic being, and if the energetic patterns in you have invited person after person after person after person to come in and attack you and created all kinds of crazy stuff in your relationships because being attacked, you were a member of the One World Religion of Blame, so you blamed the person who attacked you for what was coming up in you instead of stopping and going, oh, this person's attacking me. That's brought something up in me, this rage, this fear, this terror, this trauma. I think I'll go in and clean up my fear, my rage, my terror, and my trauma. I think I'll go into my desert, again, into my unconscious, and clean up all of the generations, all of the patterns. So Yeshua handed a tool called forgiveness, a tool with which you go within yourself and remove what never belonged. And then he taught about an elemental force that in Aramaic was called Ruach HaKodesh. So this Ruach HaKodesh is one of those concepts we need to build a whole new set of brain cells for. We need to come into a different understanding. So short form, Ruach HaKodesh is feminine. Literally, a force for that which is divinely intended for man, the third unit of the Trinity. And then what I'm going to do, if you've got the text and you want to follow along with me, then go to page 92 and we're going to look at Ruach HaKodesh. So, editor's note, Ruach HaKodesh, another symbol left in the original Aramaic sound, usually it's translated as the Holy Spirit, not because the literal meaning is not available, but because the degree of confusion of the concept illustrated. So it's left in the original Aramaic. The sound triggers the action part of Alaha that, according to John 23, must be worshipped. Worship here being to emulate. It is the Parakleta, which literally means she who breaks off the effects of error and teaches truth, and is to be all-embracingly cherished and trusted. So if we read John 14:26, for she who breaks off the effects of doings which are unfit is Ruach HaKodesh. She, my Abbe, which would be Father, will send through me. She will instruct you on all matters. She will remind you of all that I have said unto you. In other words, there is literally this helper inside. It's like you've got an internal therapist there to assist you. And most people, again, my take being that from the very beginning, because we've been focused out there, most everybody's looking for out there. Oh, the problem's out there, the solution's out there, the person who can fix me is out there, and on it goes. It's interesting, someone posted on my Facebook page the other day, and it had all the different religions. And it talked about, you know, how so-called Christianity's been waiting for 2,000 years for the return. And this one's been waiting for the return of Muhammad for 1,400 years. And this religion's been waiting for the return of their Messiah for 2,000 years. And this one's been waiting for 4,000 years and went through about 10 different religions. So everybody's sitting around waiting. Everybody's looking out there for, oh, when's it going to happen? Yeshua said, no, 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 it's within you. For she who breaks off the effects of things which are unfit is Ruach HaKodesh. She, my Abbe, will send through me. She will instruct you on all matters. She will remind you of all that I've said unto you. So Ruach HaKodesh is a feminine word. That is, it's gendered feminine in the Aramaic. You know, if you're familiar with, say, for instance, the French language, we've got L-E and L-A. One engenders whatever you're looking at, like a table. I forget. You know, my French is very rusty. But I think it's L-A, gender feminine, is a table, and the car is L-E, however that goes. But it indicates whether the word is gendered feminine or masculine. So in Aramaic, Ruach HaKodesh is gendered feminine. So the pronoun she was normally used to refer to Ruka Jakucha until the time of Constantine, when the church was massively restructured to support the imperial agenda of oppression and patriarchal superiority control. The beauty and effectiveness of Ruka Jakucha, and I'm going through this so we have the brain cells. Remember, we talk about when these words are left in the original rant, the idea is there's a whole new sense, a whole new understanding. And oh, if you ever read the book Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein, you have to grok it differently. So these words are an attempt to assist each person to get a deeper experience and sense of what this elemental force is. So the beauty and effectiveness of Ruka Jakucha is testified to by the very fact that while Constantine tried to pervert the church beyond recognition to oppress people, with time Ruka Jakucha brought the church into triumph over oppression. Ancient symbolic pictures from Egypt, South America, and elsewhere depict the use or action of four elemental forces in the creation of the universe. Humanity, augmenting its senses with all manner of devices, has yet been unable to sense or perceive any of these four forces. So you remember that Yeshua spoke of the wind when he gave an example of Ruka Jakucha, a force that they had at least some understanding of. He was introducing something that people just didn't grok. So and today, still, unfortunately, it's been lost. These four, or at least to a great degree, been lost. These forces are said to have been used with the action of Ruka Jakucha to create the physical universe and life. For instance, it is well known that the stars are expanding outward at a tremendous velocity from a central point of beginning, despite billions of years of gravitational attraction opposing their outward rush. Some immense originating expulsive force was needed to initiate their outward journey. A little typo there. Humanity's created mind, using created devices, has been able to sense such uncreated, but creative force. We can only observe the fact that it exists from the results it produces. And we now know that instead of just a Big Bang, and the universe coasted to its present condition, there's a continual increasing expansion, indicating an ongoing active expanding force. After the originating expulsive force, the coalescing action of gravity acted on the originally expulsed material to bring individual units together. As with expulsive force, this gravity force cannot be sensed directly by humans' minds nor by devices. It is interesting to note that the phrase forever and ever, or from age to age, is more accurately translated from Aramaic as from cosmic gathering to cosmic gathering, implying the Aramaic speaking people were familiar with and accepted the concept of a massive dispersal of the universe and subsequent gravitational coalescence. And they recognized this more than 2,000 years ago. However, in contrast to modern theory, they understood this expansion and coalescence to be a cycle. The third force appears to operate in the physical area, untouched by the sensing equipment of humanity, and is something associated with nuclear forces. It appears to be to prevent the orbiting electron, and we've covered this before, but it fits here again for building brain cells for this comprehension of this idea that just isn't expressible in English. From joining with the nuclear particle, the hydrogen atom, despite the electromagnetic attraction of their opposite electrical charge, this attraction is the origin or the engine of chemistry and chemical reactions. While undetected, there is no doubt as to the existence of this force. Regardless of how much we calm the activity of the hydrogen atom by freezing it, by cooling it, or how many electrons we load upon it, or how much we squeeze it, the nuclear particle refuses to accept an additional electron, and the atom remains hydrogen, a basic unit of matter. It is widely agreed that this dark energy constitutes about two-thirds of the entire universe. Almost all of the remaining one-third is so-called dark matter, which continually pops into and out of existence. In fact, less than 5% of the total universe can be detected and observed. Dark energy, matter, is therefore the vast majority of the universe, which for all practical purposes to us is not there. That part of the universe doesn't seem to be there. Our senses cannot achieve contact with it directly. We can only know it by the effects it creates, and that's the idea here of recognizing that Rukhidakudsha will be known to you by the effects she creates if and when you invite her into activity. Otherwise, it'll seem like, oh, doesn't exist. It seems reasonable that if what we call real is in fact less than 5% of the universe, we may want to consider something seemingly unreal as to what the universe is all about. Humanity cannot directly contact these forces. We can only sense their impact in a limited material universe that we think is quote-unquote real. Excuse me. The invisible forces are Rukha and have been inadequately translated as wind, breath, spirit, or pneuma. As Rukhidakudsha represents in Aramaic, Alaha, which is the invisible, unknowable source of creation, Alaha's immeasurable force upon the mind of humanity in creation, a fourth force which humanity can receive into its nafsha. In other words, we can, if we choose to become aware of it, experience the impact and effects of this feminine elemental force in us. So it can be received, but cannot be perceived. The Aramaic symbol kudsha is the Aramaic ancestor of the Hebrew word kosher. While kosher means proper, as delineated by the five books of Moses, kudsha is a broader and means proper as determined by or in harmony with the laws of oneness of humanity, whether known or unknown. It represents that which is divinely intended for humanity. Rukhidakudsha has many distinct but cooperative aspects which initiate a variety of actions. The actions are not Rukhidakudsha, but rather the result of Rukhidakudsha. These actions include life and communication from Alaha to human intelligence. So there is a telegraph line, an elemental force from which we can receive truth directly. And the whole objective of this work, the whole objective of what I've been doing for the last 50 years is to give people the tools to get their bloated nothingness out of the way, as one writer wrote, and make contact with this elemental force. Yeshua himself said, you can deny me, no big deal, but not the one I came to connect you with. So these actions are not Rukhidakudsha directly, but the result. And we can observe this force by the result. This latter action correlates with Carl Jung's universal conscience. Jung describes this as an all-pervasive web of interconnectedness between the divine and the worldly. Rukhidakudsha functions as a transmitter and communicator of Alaha's laws for humanity. John 14:26 states, she will instruct you in all matters, and she will bring you into your minds all that I have said to you. If we listen to Einstein, and we could say this, you know, recognize this as the unifying force, he says, if you think you are separate or separated from the rest of humanity, you're living in an optical delusion. But we've cut off ourselves from direct experience. of these elemental forces, and most of us live in constructs of our minds, which are nothing but reflections of the energy that's gone before us that's stored in our carbon-based memory systems within this, what was called the red clay, Adam Adamos, the red clay. And the red clay, if you asked a physicist to break it down and tell us what its base element is, they would tell you that its base element is carbon. And a carbon atom has 6 electrons, 6 protons, 6 neutrons. You might recognize that has meaning. Where is the, you know, most people are looking out there somewhere. The Antichrist is coming. Where is this anti? There is a mind of love in you, guided by love, directed by love, designed to be connected with love 24/7, 365, designed to enhance your ability to live in and out of, pardon me, in and as love for all of eternity, what we're designed for. And what do we do? Well, when we come into the world and the world starts to outer direct us to our senses in the outer world, to the 5% of what, you know, at least they theoretically believe exists, what we call the material universe makes up about 5%, the other 95% dark matter. So if our senses have been tied into the 5%, what have we done with the other? And the objective here is to recognize that this elemental force resides within us, and it can overcome that optical delusion, perceptual construct that comes from carbon-based memory. It can, that mind can be quieted, and when that mind is quieted, then we enter directly into the mind of active present love, which literally has contact with all things throughout all space and all time. And as Yeshua described it, will bring to mind that which I have taught you. So my, you know, and I thank you for the question that that opened things up, because that question, much appreciated, Sean, ties right in with the conversation I had with someone who was asking about Ruach HaKodesh and how it all fits together. So if we want to clean up this multi-generational database, how do we do it with a 9-bit mind, with perception? It can't be done. But there is this elemental force in us which literally will undo the effects of our errors and teach us the truth. So that's where we want to go with all of this, and I hope that fits and makes sense. And if it leaves anybody with any thoughts or questions, please, if you're on one of those stations where we can't see you in our control panel, the calling number is 563-999-3581. We call that number, you're listening to the show directly, and then if you have a question or thought for us, push 1, and that will raise your hand in the control panel, and we'll be having a conversation.
Michael, we
so,
do Christine, have...
I think I heard you. Go for it.
Yes. We do have 2 hands up, but we had a question in the chat in on Podbean, and
okay,
she says,
great.
I know I've already asked this, but I must have blocked the answer. How do I forgive thinking about my nephew who is a liar? So it's not forgiving her nephew, but forgive thinking about her nephew. She goes on to say, I don't want him to lie.
Yep. Okay. So as Jeannie just said, we're not going to ever suggest that you forgive your nephew for being a liar. But we're going to suggest that you apply forgiveness inside of you to begin to deal with the part of you that holds that idea and whatever the disturbing energy is about lying. So Remember that the most successful distraction in history is blame. It's a brainwash has become virtually universal. And again, most everybody by the age of 4 is a full-fledged, devoted, card-carrying member of the One World Universal Religion of Blame. And most of us have no idea how we got that way. And we've each been taught to believe the graven images, the pictures that show up in our mind, constructed by our mind, and we think that that picture, which is a construct based on what's resonating in us, and that picture is painted on the inside of my eyeballs, and the feelings, the emotions, the energies that move with that picture, I've been taught, are caused by somebody out there. Our offering is they're not caused by somebody out there. What you're experiencing is what's moving inside of you. When we don't understand these constructs are internally generated, the disturbance, the upset is internally generated. And it's not what's happening in the world, but reflect first and foremost the dissociated content of our own mind. That's why I'm in disturbance. You know, if I confront somebody who's a liar, I look and I go, oh, they're a liar, and I go on with my day. But if I look at somebody and go, oh, they're a liar, that's my content. Notice, to tap into that, to go to that kind of energy, my body has to tighten, my breath has to change. That's an internal construct. And yes, I paint it on the inside of my eyeballs, and I think I'm looking out through my eyeballs, so I think I'm looking at something out there. But what I'm looking at is the dissociated content of my own mind. And the primary work to be done, if you're going to reach a state of serenity, is to access and forgive or remove that disturbed content of your own mind. And, you know, probably one of the greatest atrocities done to us as human beings down through the ages and that we bought into is that we've had hidden from us the fact that we are by nature creators. And if you notice the way life is showing up, that's your creation, including your nephew. When you recognize that, then you'll see that this is your next piece of work, and that work is your healing. If you blame your nephew for your response to his lies, or at least what you perceive to be his lies, then you're dissociating from what's coming up in you. And you miss your own healing opportunity. So my suggestion would be that you put his name on a worksheet in number 1C, and then you start in number 1A, I, and you write your name in and be really clear who you are as love. Am feeling what? Am I feeling sadness? Am I feeling anger? Am I feeling fear? What's going on for me? What's resonated in me? What's triggered in me that I'm in a disturbed state? Now, my mind tells me I'm in that disturbed state because he lied. But I'm not in that disturbed state because he lied. I'm in that disturbed state because I have that quality of disturbance in me. And if I ever want to be finished with that quality of disturbance, you'll notice, and of course I haven't asked you the question, but you'll notice this isn't the first time you felt this quality of disturbance. And if you never forgive it, it won't be the last. So you go through the reality management forgiveness process and you remove from your mind that disturbed energy that's moving in you. Once you clean that up, you'll come back to your nephew, and you might be shocked to find that all of a sudden he's changed and he doesn't lie anymore. Or maybe he's not going to change. Maybe he's never going to change, and he'll continue to lie, and you'll just stand as a centered, connected space of love when you're in his presence, because there's no disturbance left in you about being lied to or about lying. So that would be my offering, going through the forgiveness process until you're free of whatever the disturbing response is in yourself. And once you do that and you stand in the space of your nephew as the presence of love, the tendency will be for his behaviors to change. But, you know, there's only 2 square feet that you can change and they're your own. And so that would be my answer. That would be what I would suggest that you would do. Now, you can take literally every other tool that we have and apply it as well. But the primary one I would offer in this case would be to apply the forgiveness process to literally access the disturbed energy in you that seems to be about him lying, but is really just a disturbed energy in you that when you're free of it, you're going to be healthy, more vital, more alive, and more serene. So that would be my input on it. If you have any other thoughts, go ahead and put them in the chat, and Jeannie can share them with us.
In the meantime, let's get our caller.
Awesome.
Area code 734. I believe this is Melanie. We haven't heard from you in a while. Welcome.
Hi, can you hear me?
You're loud and clear. Welcome, Melanie. Good to hear your voice. How can
Hi,
we support you?
I don't know
you?
How you remember me. I recently, I have a couple questions.
Okay.
Earlier you were talking about Ruka Dukusha, and I'm wondering if there's anywhere like on your website or somewhere where I can access more information about it. I couldn't really hear you that well because there was a lot of background noise, but I've been wondering about that myself.
Okay. Is there a lot of background noise coming from the show, or are you somewhere where there's background noise?
I have a noisy bedroom, and I have a three-year-old running around, so.
Oh, okay. Okay, I understand. Well, one, when the show is over, you can go to our website, whyagain.org, and in the middle of the homepage, you'll see a link with a picture of a microphone, or you'll see a picture of a microphone. Okay. If you click on that and drill down, you can download and listen to today's show, so you can listen to it again.
Okay, I already
there
that.
Is
yeah,
a,
you didn't need to tell me that. Sorry.
Okay. There is a section on the website on the Aramaic, and or if you are interested in getting a copy of the book, you can order that as well, the book that we're working with. I'm
what
not sure offhand. The book we're working with is called Enlightenment. It's what we've published so far from the Kabbalah's manuscript. And the Kabbalah's manuscript is a copy of the oldest known New Testament in its original Aramaic language translated that we're translating into English. Enlightenment is what we have published so far from that text. If you go to our catalog on our website, you can order the book, and it's $25 plus shipping. With the radio show, if you just order without going to our catalog, because the catalog, the website automatically adds shipping, there's nothing we can do about that. But if you want to order the book, we'll pay the shipping if you just go to our website, and down at the bottom of the page, there's a donate button. And if the book sells for $25, PayPal, which your payment goes through, takes about a dollar and change out of it. So if you just donate $26, we'll pay for the shipping and get it off to you. If you decide to do that, you go to whyagain.org, go to the bottom of the page, hit the donate button, put in $26, and then give us your name and your address, and then it's for Enlightenment, and we'll get it shipped off to you right away.
Okay, thanks. I also wanted to ask, it might be a stupid question, but
no stupid
you've been talking
questions.
About healing generational trauma, and like I had an experience this morning that warranted doing a worksheet, and I kind of feel like I'm wasting my time when I go through a single worksheet when I kind of already know maybe not the exact original experience that caused the trauma that it's resonating, but I guess...
Breathe.
I mean, I know... Yeah, right. you just told that one lady to continue doing worksheets until you're free of the disturbing response in yourself. And I know I don't take a lot of time to do that because I don't feel like I have enough time, but...
I hear you.
Wouldn't it be more... I know that's an excuse, but that's just how I feel sometimes. Wouldn't it be more productive
with a two-year-old,
to do the
I understand, Melanie.
Wouldn't it be more productive to do, like, the original worksheet first? Like a worksheet from when you were a kid or when you were really young? Or?
Well, you know, any situation or circumstance that you're aware of that relates to what's going on for you, whether it's when you were 2 years old or, you know, I've had people do worksheets on memories they had from being in the womb. So, yes, whatever time frame that you're in touch with, whether it's today or that kind of a memory, and in fact, you know, let's say, for instance, sometimes let's say there's a situation, especially with you being a mom with a young baby, oftentimes things will come up with, you know, one's own parents, mom or dad. And, you know, we'll suggest to somebody, okay, so do the worksheet around that situation. And then if they're not resolved, one of the things we'll oftentimes say is, so now imagine that you are, you know, let's say the interaction was with dad. Imagine that you are dad and you do a worksheet as your father around that same situation. That can open up wide vistas of what needs to be healed. And one of the things that, you know, I'm very aware of with having developed this process and been doing it for years with people is that there'll be times when you'll do, you know, you may have to cancel a goal 10 times in a minute, i.e. do the equivalent of 10 worksheets in a minute because the intensity of what's moving. And then you may hit a plateau where, gee, you know, I've done 20 worksheets on this in the last 3 weeks and it just isn't moving. And then all of a sudden, bang, that next layer starts to move. And it's just, you know, when you recognize the generational nature of these traumatic patterns, it's doesn't always follow any rhyme or reason as to how quickly it resolves, how long it takes to resolve, or when it gets resolved.
Okay. If you do a worksheet as a parent, would you do the worksheet like channeling their personal experience of a traumatic experience or a worksheet them perpetrating something against you?
What I've done when I do something like that is I'll imagine that I'm with them and breathing into their space, and I imagine that I am them. I ask permission. I imagine I am them, and I do that worksheet on exactly the same situation as I just did the worksheet on for myself. Now, that might be a worksheet that I do, you know, I, as my mother, might do a worksheet on me as her son. I, as my mother, might do a worksheet on her relationship with her mother. That seems to be the thing that impacts us. Again, any variety of things that come to mind that seem apparent at this moment as impacting the situation can be appropriate for doing a worksheet. And when you realize the generational influence, and with a child of two, there would tend to be the resonance of, I think, more of that generational stuff, then certainly patience with the process is a requirement, because I don't know when it's going to unfold. I mean, I can think of issues in my life that I have worked on for decades and seen resolution happen over the decades that just didn't seem available originally when I worked on those things. And and for me, my best understanding of that is those are the patterns that are so deeply embedded in our genes and our family history that, you know, nobody's going to pull them out and be done with them in one particular session.
Then what do we do about our children? Like, do we have to do worksheets for them too? Because they
well,
have too,
if you
right?
go to, Absolutely. You know, one of the things, our granddaughter is five, and we talk with her about forgiveness all the time, and we talk with her about the tools. The first year and a half or so, every day when I did the radio show when she was here, and that was usually 2 to 3 days a week, it was her nap time when we were doing the radio show, and she'd be laying on the crook of my arm while I'm doing the radio show with the headset on, listening to it. And we talked to her about it. There was an interesting, you know, event that happened just a few weeks ago with Jeannie and Aria. And Aria had some stuff going on, and all of a sudden, Aria brought one of her dolls to Jeannie and explained that the doll was having trouble and asked Jeannie if she would help her to work through it, and then sat there while Jeannie verbalized walking through a worksheet with her doll.
But did she do a children's worksheet or a regular one?
Well, we'll have to ask Jeannie that. I don't know. I would imagine that she probably watered it down to the level of experience where Ari would do it, but I wasn't physically present for that. Sweetie, if you want to share that.
Yeah, I didn't have an actual physical worksheet with me, but she said her doll was sad. And so I talked to the doll, and of course Ari is sitting there listening to every word, but I addressed everything to the doll. And I said, well, you know, I know that you're sad, but, you know, and what you're thinking is that you wanted this toy and it was broken, but, you know, you've got, and I just kind of walked her through, and I said, so we have to cancel our goal for that doll to, or the other toy to not be broken, and just, mm-hmm. you know, look at all the other toys that you have, and, you know, you can be happy. You don't have to, you know, feel sad. And just kind of walked her through, and so then when we got finished, I handed the doll back to Aria, and Aria said, well, she's still a little sad, but she feels better, you know. Okay. And but Aria has also learned that, you know, what we say, and a lot of times, you know, our words are not really what we want. Like if you say, don't fall down the steps, the focus is still on falling down the steps. And so, you know, we say, well, cancel that thought because we don't really want that to happen. And she has gotten to where she told us that her classmates wouldn't cancel their thoughts. And she said, so I cancel them for them. So if she hears a child say something about, you know, oh, you're going to fall, then Aria will say, well, you need to cancel that thought. You know, and so she's teaching them even though they don't understand what she's doing. And so she's getting it. She's just five, but she's getting it that, you know, it's her goals that is the cause of the upset, and that if she cancels the goal, that the upset will go away, that our emotions are attached to our thoughts. And I did send you an email with a whole bunch of information about what Michael just read and then also about Rock McCubbin. So you'll have an email from me on that.
Okay, thank you. I just noticed also, that with my son especially, he has issues or focuses on things that are resonant of, I feel like, you talk about generationally inherited trauma, and I think it comes from me because I almost feel like I know exactly why he has that perception.
Right.
And he used the Julie Haverstick book for a while, but I don't have it anymore. But I don't know. That's really good that you have instilled that in that little girl for her whole life.
Melanie, if you go to the website, and if you go to the website and click on Start Here, I'll send you that link directly to it too. But all of Julie's worksheets are on the website, so you can download just the worksheet.
Okay, thank you.
Also, if you go to your app store on your phone and type in Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, you've got the app?
Yeah, I have it.
So
I don't feel
app,
like I like this much as an actual worksheet, but...
Okay. Well, you might just check the game as a way to introduce kids to it. And also, if you decide that you want to order the Enlightenment book, Julie's book is also $25 plus shipping if you order it from our
website
store. But if you decide you want to order the one, if you want to, Julie's book sells for the same thing, and if you want to just do a donation of $52, we'll pay the shipping for both of them and ship them to you if you decide you want to do that. So there won't be that shipping charge involved. So you'll have that book back in hand again.
Okay, thank you.
Cool. Delighted. And we're here to support you the best we possibly can, and it's a delight to hear your voice.
You too. Take care.
All right. Blessings. All right. Bye-bye. All right, Miss Jeannie, we've got another hand up.
Well, we did, but he dropped it back down. I believe it was Dusty, area code 904. You're on the air.
You still with us, Dusty? I heard something kick in, but not quite there. Is your mute button on, Dusty? If you're saying anything, I can't hear you. Okay, I think we must have lost him, Gene.
Okay.
And we've got about 3 minutes left, so time for a... Go ahead, Gene.
I was just going to say, you've got 3 minutes.
Yeah. So if anybody's got a quick question we can get into, that would be awesome. If not,
and
then
the
I'll just share that.
The person on Podbeam said, yes, that helped. Thank you. And we did have a question yesterday, but I don't know that you've got time to get into it. And they were in Podbeam, and I did answer them in the chat room. But they wanted to know what they could do to get rid of the fear that they have about ghosts, spirits, and shadows.
Well, you know, all of the above would be my answer to that one. I mean, you could use every tool we've got. You know, first of all, recognize that your fear is not about ghosts, spirits, and shadows. Your fear is just about the fact that there's fear. And so the trigger that activates it is the idea of ghosts, shadows, what have you. And so my input would be to start doing some forgiveness work around fear itself. And make sure that you breathe. You know, fear changes the whole pattern of energy flow throughout the body. It leaves people in a state of what's called sympathetic dominance, which compromises blood flow to all of the higher faculties of the brain, to the functions of rest and digestion. And it shunts, literally physically shunts blood to the larger muscles of the arms and the legs to get us ready to fight or run, and to the lungs to enable us to take in more oxygen so we can fight or run. But virtually everything else in the system is compromised by fear. And so my input would be to really seriously sit down and do some really serious work on that fear and start moving it out of your structure. And the forgiveness would be the primary tool that I would suggest using, that reality management worksheet. If you don't have the app, you could go to your app store and just type in the words Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, Aramaic forgiveness, and you'll see an app with a glowing heart come up in the list. Download that one, and you've got the worksheets right there to go to work and work with letting loose of that that fear. And in the meantime, we'll be holding the space for the healing of it and the willingness. And we'll invite everybody on the show into the willingness to do another level of work on letting go of fear. And we breathe with you. Hold you in the blessing. Everybody, thank you for joining us. Create the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings. Bye-bye.